Well, good morning. We're very pleased today to have Liberia's Minister of Defense come to speak to us today. He will be talking to us primarily about Liberia's military restructuring, some of the opportunities that have come with the strategy that Liberia has chosen, and also some of the challenges that they have faced. Prior to his appointment as minister, he was the principal security advisor to the UN designated official in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. He also served in Tanzania as the principal security advisor to the head of the sub-office for UNHCR in Kibondo, where he was responsible for 130,000 refugees. And prior to that, he was the security advisor to the regional officer of Amara region in Northwest East Timor, where he was responsible for the evacuation of 120 UN employees and their dependents following the 2000 elections there. He has served as the Liberian Deputy Minister of State for Administration from 95 to 97. Prior to that, he was Director of the Liberian National Police from 94 to 95. And from 91 to 94, he was the Deputy Minister of Defense for Operations, where he was responsible for reestablishing civilian control of the Liberian Army and establishing an emergency response team to counter urban terrorism. So he comes to us with a wealth of experience. Welcome, Minister Samakai. Sorry, if I can ask you to please turn off your cell phones, because they interfere with not only our recording equipment, but I'm sure the camera in the back.
Well, thank you for that very warm introductory statement. I'm very glad to be here this morning. I see some notable faces. Mr. Jack Klein, good to see you. Yeah, thank you very much for coming. This morning, I would like to share with you some of our views, as indicated, with regards to the security sector reform as it relates to the contracting of that service to a private security company. The issues and the discussions will center around our own experience. And finally, we will end up with our own suggestions as the continued way forward as another option as to how we can proceed. First, I'd like to begin by saying thanks to the Institute for providing me the opportunity to be here this morning to share with you these ideas, particularly our, all of us, interest in the restructuring of the armed forces of Liberia by a private U.S. security company. The genesis of the whole process, you will recall, was at the end of the Accra Peace Conference in 2003, when the Liberian parties to the conflict decided that there was a need, an overwhelming need, for the restructuring of the armed forces of Liberia. At that time, it was not easy to determine what would have been the cost implication. But I think the U.S., it was agreed in the agreement that the United States government would take the lead role in the restructuring process of the military. An initial assessment was done, and there was talk about raising a brigade of about 4,000 plus persons to come and assist, provide the kind of security that will be needed under the restructure program. But after second thought, and after looking at the resource availability by government, it was realized that there was an ambitious plan that the Liberian government would have been unable to support and sustain such a full structure, although that was the need. So what came out was that the United States government publicly came out and said, okay, they will provide the funding, about $200 million or so, to restructure and retrain a downsized number of 2,000 personnel brigade for the new armed forces of Liberia, along with 94 persons, civilian staff of the Ministry of National Defense. There was an argument initially as to whether there was a need for an army in Liberia. I mean, the logic of the region itself and the conflict in the region tells you that there is a dire need for that to have happened. Look at Guinea with over 10,000 person military. Look at Sierra Leone, about 11,000 or so, and look at the Ivory Coast. So if you see the conflict emerging in the region, there is a need for Liberia, which is you know, border with the Atlantic Ocean right at his end and nowhere else to run in order to get some help. The need for protecting his border became absolutely necessary. So the retraining of the Liberian military is not new in itself. For over 40 years, between the period of 1957 and 1998, there was a U.S. military mission in Liberia. That military mission provided military training to members of the AFL. And of course, at the time, they were called the Liberian National Guard. They were being trained in different programs, trainers of trainers programs. Some of them went back to Liberia to provide training for the Liberian military as it was emerging. Military occupational specialties were developed through the U.S. Assistance, and many persons came to the States to military institutions here for military training. Most importantly, the U.S. Department of Defense sent an active duty team of military personnel to work along with the Liberian Department of War, as it was called at the time, to help train and create a new corps of officers and NCOs for the Liberian military. And I can say to you, I'm also personally standing here, I am a beneficiary of that same AMET training program. So the program was very successful, with the United States military personnel coming to Liberia on a military training team, on a military mission to provide training to Liberian military persons. So those persons were committed to their service, committed to their command. Assessment was very easy, and in terms of discipline and order, it's strictly according to military rules that it would have had. However, this time around, things were a little bit different. The restructure and retraining of the Liberian military was contracted to a private firm. It also became obvious that the previous understanding we had, wherein the U.S. military mission would have come and work along directly with the Liberian in determining, planning, and coordinating the training, this time around, the decision-making of the retraining was redirected from a mission to an office. That is the Office of Defense Cooperation. We had a presence and maintains a presence in Monrovia. Notwithstanding, the restructuring process began in January of 2006, just after the inauguration of the newly elected government. Prior to that, we had phase one of the process after the agreement was signed in 2003. Phase one went through an entire redocumentation process of the AFL personnel, those who were mobilized in the 1990 conflict. There were cost determination of severance payments, how much to pay them, on what rank, for how many years of service. Severance payments for demobilized persons, those who were recruited in 1990. At the same time, the payment to next of kin. There were persons who were redocumented but died prior to the time they received their money. So the whole process of redocumenting the entire AFL took place at the time. So the figure captured at the time was a little bit closer to 14,000, about 13,800 and something. But then as the months went by, you had additional persons coming. So the second phase then, after that, payment of those AFL personnel, provided those salaries and severance payments to them, widows as well. The second phase was the recruiting process for the new armed force of Liberia. There was no restriction as to whether former personnel of the AFL could come to join or not. You were open to come and join, but again, you have to follow the new criteria that came out. You had to go through the process, and you must be clear from that process before you come back. And if you came in, you'll be coming back to start from ground zero. So there was the recruitment process, the vetting process. After the vetting process, you present them to the Joint Personnel Board, of which the United States and Liberia are co-chairs, and a member of civil society. In this case, the Dean of the Law School at the University of Liberia is a member of civil society that is serving on the Joint Personnel Board. The Joint Personnel Board then have to approve the recommendation of the recommended recruits prior to their going into training. But before going to training, they publish their list and pictures all around the country for anyone who have information on these individuals or these potential recruits, on their human rights activities, on their personal lives, any information that is available as part of the vetting process prior to the completion of the vetting. And then phase three, finally, is the beginning of the training process, where all of them went through the normal basic individual entry training, advanced individual training. Because we had no sergeants, we had to put in a non-commissioned officer course. And then because there are no officers, so there was an officer candidate classes that were also conducted. So from the time the soldier went in up to the time he graduated as an officer, it was about 31 weeks. So a very long period of time that provided he or she all of the knowledge he or she needs to begin the training as a second lieutenant. And then that followed, which is ongoing now, the mentorship training program. From the onset, the contractor demonstrated an outstanding ability of public awareness. I mean, there was a lot of information that Bill Bull provided as to what was to obtain. What were the process and steps that people needed to follow? Where did you need to go? What kind of documentation you needed to bring? With the insistence of officials of the newly elected government, the minimum standard for enlistment was raised from junior high, that is from an eighth grade or middle school level, to a high school. That is, you must be a high school graduate in order to join the new army. And if you wanted to be an officer, you must come in minimally as a college graduate as the minimum criteria for joining the army. A credible vetting process was put in place for the selection of potential recruits into the AFL. The contractor put in place a reliable and timely database that would go access on any applicant at any point in time, and they amassed a very good record of the process and procedure during the vetting process. We felt that the credibility of the vetting process was outstanding, and we supported the vetting process without interference or without disruption. On our part of the government, we provided absolutely duty-free privileges for imports by the contractor for this purpose and facilitated at either no cost or very minimum cost all visa entry requirements by the contractor. The government also provided unrestricted access to information from the public and all government institutions on all applicants. That if you needed to know anything about any applicant, it was going to be made available to you. And we provided them with absolutely free latitude without input on our part in determining the testing, evaluation, and recommendation process for any applicant. The whole idea was to make sure that there was no interference like before. In the past, you had one group of society sending a list for person to join the army. You had the executive doing the same thing. You had the legislature that is also doing the same thing. You have business community persons. You have interest group. So this time around, we try to make sure that from the government, from the president down, there will be no interference in that process. So to date, nearly 8,000 applicants or so, both men and women, have gone through this vetting process, with approximately 12% successfully recommended to the Joint Personnel Board, which is co-chaired by the U.S. and the Liberian government. Now, if you look at those numbers, the president, our plan is to see if we can have 20% of the force structure of 2,000 to be women. It is a very uphill battle we're working on. Right now, we're operating between 3 and 7%, depending on which of the numbers, which numbers at which time you're looking at when those persons are being recruited. Since July 22, 2006, when the training began, only 105 personnel out of the 2,000 persons of the AFL have been trained. Recently, on May 8, 2007, just a couple of days ago, the first 9 officers of the nearly 110 future officers of the new AFL were commissioned into the Armed Forces of Liberia. So that means we still got a long way to go. But let me add that following this training, there's another training, a mentorship, for the force composition of these persons where they develop their military occupational specialty while they are in base. That is ongoing, but that service has also been contracted out. I must say to you, though, there is a difference here. Today, the 11th of May, at Camp Kesley Barracks in Monrovia, an active duty U.S. military nursing and combat medic training has been completed, and the trainees are graduating today. This exercise was carried out by active duty personnel of the United States military. The Ministry of Defense was part of the coordination and approval process of these active duty personnel to have come to Liberia to provide this training. The quality of instructions and mechanism for assessment were outstanding. The personnel were transparent in their attitude, and they were accountable to their service because they are active duty personnel. There was visible cooperation and coordination with other national health institutions, among others. These trainers were on a mission based on orders from their superior officers. The interaction of professional military medic personnel with Liberian institutions has fostered the kind of capacity building that any nation like us in a restructuring process will wish to have. The many challenges we experienced in the assessment of various options led us to the conclusion of rethinking such options for future training programs. After these experiences, we believe that the conduct of basic training and force composition of armed forces is best handled and professionally achieved by active duty military personnel. Our experience with the medic trainers has shown that the trainers remain focused on their mission. Their orders were very clear, and their chain of command and authority unambiguous. They were respectful to local authorities and did not exhibit lifestyles or attitude beyond their mission. They did not suffer the constraints of funding. U.S. mobile training teams have performed their mission utilizing specialists with experience and outstanding leadership, clarity, tact, commitment, and lessons learned. Specialized training demands exceptional qualities and proven experience in those being recruited. It requires persons of higher levels of experience, training, and command responsibility. For example, the training of battalion brigade officers requires qualified officers who have served at the battalion brigade or strategic decision-making levels. The logic of replacing an experienced and well-respected United States Army colonel with a senior NCO is questionable. It may be that their professional performance and conduct are not necessarily to the quality of their work, but to the terms of their contract, which is conditioned on real-time attentiveness by those evaluating the program. Contractors may have no loyalty to the objective of the host country, rather to the satisfaction of their contract. On the other hand, active duty military personnel have demonstrated loyalty and commitment to their superiors and to their service, and have shown accountable performance to their superior officers while on mission. Liberia has had a successful experience in working alongside active duty U.S. military personnel in achieving a common objective. Liberia will continue to support and heartily welcome the training, experience, mentorship, and assistance from active duty U.S. military personnel for generalized formation of its new armed forces. We will also appreciate specialized training from specialist individuals or companies with legacy of experience, trust, and integrity. Now, on hindsight, I believe Liberia has gotten the benefit of two options. But I say to you, Liberia's preference remains very clear. And that preference is demonstrated in the recent training of the combat medics by active duty serving personnel. We want to express our thanks and profound gratitude to the U.S. government and the American people for their generosity in providing the assistance and necessary financial and logistical support in restructuring and retraining the armed forces of Liberia. We look forward to your continued support and generosity in helping Liberia achieve its objective of training a 2,000 personnel brigade. We also want to say that given the historical relationship between our two countries, and Liberia's commitment to supporting the strategic interests of our two nations, the Liberian people are hopeful that the U.S. AFRICOM will consider having a credible presence in Liberia as a reassuring factor, not only for Liberia, but for the West African region as a whole. Liberia may not have all of the facilities at this time, but the Liberian people will welcome AFRICOM with openness, friendship, commitment, respect, and less headache for force protection. The Liberian people appreciate the American people, and AFRICOM has both the political support of the Liberian government and the friendship of the Liberian people. I want to say thanks to the Institute of Peace for providing me this opportunity. I hope I have laid a basis for our interaction, and I'll be more than willing and open to answer your questions. Thank you.
Well, the floor is open. If you could please identify yourself. Thank you very much, Minister Samakai.
Thank you. Hi, Nicholas Cook from the Congressional Research Service. I have three very brief questions. One is, could you describe the gendarme force? Now, this is a police force, I believe, but what's its status and relation to the military? This is that small quick reaction force that's under development. Second, could you give us an update on the status of the national security strategy? And what role, if any, does DynCorp have in writing it? And then third, could you just talk a little bit about the budget implications of funding the new force in future years? How much of the Liberian budget will that take, and are there sustainability issues at all? Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. First, the Cure Reaction Unit, as it is called, is presently under development. It is an idea. If you take into consideration Liberia's landmass, you take into consideration Liberian neighbors, the ability of the government, the threat level, you realize that a 2,000-person force, the AFL, may be inadequate to carry on such a mission. So the idea would be to look at it within a global context of not only the military, but also the police, the regular police, the quick reaction unit, the immigration services, along with customs, the special security services, and intelligence. So you have to take the entire global picture. So the quick reaction force, which will be a part of the police, is under development, and that consideration is being taken place right now. The QRF will have a good relationship with the military. That is our anticipation. So that the QRU will be able to carry on its functions to deal with armed-related incidences, to deal with initial threats involving weapons, mass riots, mass demonstration, hostage situation, initial act of terrorism, those kind of responses will be the kind of thing the QRU will be looking forward to performing. I'm sure the Inspector General of Police will probably be able to say more on that. But at this point in time, the Minister of Defense and the Armed Forces of Liberia will be supportive to coordination, provision of information and intelligence to them as well. On the national security strategy, DANCO has no part to play into that. That is being developed by the government through the different agencies that they have. That is the National Security. We have the National Security Council. We have the Government Reform Commission. We have the security pillar under the government. All of them are part of the process in developing and drafting a national security strategy. But DINCO or the contractors have nothing to do with that strategy. But I must add, though, that there have been other think tanks from the U.S., like the RAND Corporation, who provided some technical expertise. Their report, their work is also being factored into the process as well. In terms of budgetary implications, yes. There are a lot of socioeconomic demands to the government. And those demands are really overwhelming. Looking at the amount of years of conflict, the destruction that have taken place, the needs assessment that have been done, both by the international community, both by the people in the region, both by our bilateral partners, there is a tremendous amount of need for social services to our people. So the budget for the security will still, even in today's term, still only remain a very single-digit percentage of the entire budget. So it's a little bit, we're hoping that as the economy expands, and as the envelope increases, and as the need becomes necessary, maybe there might be some further reconsideration. Thank you.
Good morning, Jacques Klein, former SRSG in Liberia. Mr. Minister, I think very diplomatically laid out the contrast between private security contractors and professional military. Most of us who've been in the military would obviously support your argument. Professional military is the better option. My question is on pay.
Yes, sir.
The tragedy for Africa historically has been that quite often the military, once it's trained, is the only institution in the country that has the mobility, the communications, the administrative structure, the command structure to really get things done. And inevitably, when soldiers don't have a, quote, a real mission, they tend to sit in barracks and watch Rambo movies and at some point become disenchanted with their civilian administrators and say, I could do a better job.
Right.
Now, when generals do that, I don't mind. I used to be a general, so that's all right if you're president. I do resent it when sergeants try to assume those kinds of responsibilities. So my question is, who's going to pay for this ultimately in the long term? Now it's covered, but can Liberia, with the limited budget resources you have and the pressures in medicine, healthcare, and elsewhere, can afford to pay? The second issue is one of coastal control. As you know, when we were there, we clearly documented, and I sent out a helicopter once, we had 15 ships. All had their names covered, none were flying national flags, all were doing illegal fishing or dumping bilge or what have you. To me, Liberia's coast is one of the richest elements of Liberia's future economy. Where is the Coast Guard element or the naval element in that part of the equation? Thank you.
Thank you very much, SRSG. You know, we remember you well. The people of Liberia do remember you well, and I do. And we're very thankful for the efforts you made while you were serving in our country. If I may, what the government has done has accepted that if you train the military, you must support and pay them. So the military, with our recommendation, set out a standard in which the minimum salary for the soldiers, both, I mean, in U.S. terms, or maybe in the U.S., if you hear such a figure, you probably might think it is your gas, your weekly gas consumption. But it's going to be about $90. But if you look at that within the West African region, that is very high. If you look at the standards that are there, but don't look at the $90 minimum in isolation. Look at the $90 within the following context. The soldier is going to be provided free housing, free utilities, including electricity and running water. The soldier is going to have the opportunity to go to the best schools that we would pay for. The soldier will be, we have insurance, both life and death for he and his family, up to those who are not exceeding the age of 17. So if you were to add all of that value, you will see that it is much more added benefit to the soldier than just a single $90. And thirdly, we intend to ensure that the soldiers are trained so that when they leave the service, they will have marketable skills for the future. They'll be trained as quality security personnel. They'll be trained as quality computer operators. They'll be trained as very good nurses, medics, if you want to put it in that sense. They'll be trained as engineers. They'll be trained as lawyers. So the whole idea is that the soldiers once trained and deciding to retire or to leave the service will have the future that they can look forward. It's a lack of the opportunity in future that they're looking forward to that sometimes brings about these things. Fourthly, the government is a democratic government and intend to remain so. We have no intention to trample upon the rights of any group or any persons for any reason whatsoever, whether it's ethnicity or otherwise. And we want to make sure that the military remain apolitical. That is why the vetting process involves the public itself. The public is involved in the vetting process. The public helps to provide information. The public appreciate the kinds of person that the government intends to hire in order to provide weapons to. I cannot guarantee by my statement that the actions of the person may not change in future. But I can say for a fact that the process of democracy that we set out now, the process of good government, the process of accountability, and the process of transparency in people's action and attitude, would demonstrate the seriousness on the part of the government to ensure that persons in the military are respected, but they themselves will respect their civilian authorities. And I think the SRSD, Mr. Klein, you are very much correct on the issue of the coastal, the need for a coastal surveillance, coastal patrol, coastal interdiction on Liberian waters. We continue to receive evidence both from the United Nations, both from bilateral partners on illegal fishing, illegal crossing, and probably other activities that we may not even be aware of. The new Defense Act that is on a draft right now has its section that brings back the Liberian National Coast Guard with clearly defined responsibilities. There is still one issue that is still need to be worked on the Coast Guard element, and that is who has jurisdiction if you give it under the Minister of Defense, who has the right to board, who has the right to interdict, who has the right to arrest. Where does the law enforcement function takes place there? So once those can be clear-cut, clearly defined, it makes it easier for the parties that is for the some kind of joint cooperation. From the Minister of Defense side, we believe that you can have a system where the vessel is being maintained and operated by personnel and institution that already has the structure to take care of that. That is the military. However, the right to interdict, whether to stop illegal trafficking, illegal fishing, the right to board will be borne also by other agencies that have law enforcement functions, like the customs for individuals doing contraband trading. For example, immigration for persons involved in illegal trafficking or trying to illegally enter our waters. Illegal fisheries by the Minister of Agriculture. So a joint cooperation can take place. Is that happening now? I can say yes. As of Wednesday, 2 days ago, the Ministry of Agriculture called a conference, a meeting comprising all of these different agencies to see if we can come up with some kind of coordinated mechanism to be able to respond. But it is a huge challenge. We have a very long coast, and for quite a long time, there have been a lot of illegal fishing. You will need not only the vessel, but you need a mean for signal, for response, and a lot more things that will be needed. So I think Mr. Klein is absolutely right. It is a big challenge for us.
Thank you. My name is Paul Ndiho, Voice of America. Honorable Minister, I wanted you to comment on the on the integration of the former combatants. I've read somewhere where they're saying that some of your critics are saying that you guys have denied them the opportunity to be integrated into the new army. What is your your comment on that?
Thank you. I must say that the new military is strictly voluntary. Anyone has a right to go and apply. But you must subject yourself to the vetting process, to the scrutiny of the institution, and the scrutiny of the community itself. So no one, whether it's a former combatant, whether it's a former EFF personnel, former rebel, like Lord, Model, any one of those factions, your Limo G, NPFL, you have the right to apply. You are a free citizen. But you must subject your application to the scrutiny of the process. And there's no exception to the process. There's no special case. That is exactly what brought the army to what it is today. Because each group and each individual has specific interests and therefore specific individuals into the army. So they were no longer serving the country, but rather serving those institutions and special interests. We have to get rid of that if we have to have a unified military. And that is exactly what we have put in place. So former commandants have the right to want to join the military, but they have to subject to the scrutiny of the process. Yes, sir.
Mr. Minister, I'm Donald Shirk, and I'm the former U.S. Executive Director to the African Development Bank when it was headquartered in Abidjan, close to you. I wasn't a general, Jacques, but I was a captain in the United States, captain in the United States Army. Your discussion of the force levels of some of your neighboring states,
yes, sir,
brought to mind something that I have been concerned about for a number of years. The African Development Bank's charter calls for it to play a role in economic integration of the African states. Now, economic integration can take a variety of forms, as I'm sure you're aware. But it would seem to me to be worth exploring whether or not there could be some level of integration of the different armed forces in West Africa, perhaps a joint command, perhaps joint training. Would you care to comment on that, if whether or not it's a viable opportunity for Liberia at this stage of its development? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir. You are absolutely right. As I speak to you now, the ECOWAS countries are working on, with the support and assistance of international partners, including the U.S., Britain, France, Canada, and other countries, to set up what they call the ECOWAS Standby Force, the ESF, which comprise all of the countries in Africa, I mean West Africa, including Liberia. There have been ongoing discussions. It moved into identification of training locations, identification of the table organization and equipment, identification of the logistical base, identification of the command structure of that. So that has been worked on, and I believe it supports the whole idea of some kind of military integration, as not only as an early warning, but as a first responder in bringing stability to where there is emerging conflict. And if the African Development Charter speaks in those terms, I do believe ECOWAS would like to follow that up as well. But yes, there is a kind of integration of efforts in ECOWAS countries to the establishment of the ECOWAS Standby Force. I am sure within the next maybe year or two, when they become mission ready, I'm sure they'll be able to make that announcement and to let the general public know. But they do have the support of the U.S., the Canadians, or the British, and other countries that I've gone and participated in one of their meetings. And I've seen that this whole idea that you have talked about before is being worked on right now. Thank you,
sir. Sharianne Vincent in the Department of Peacekeeping Operations at the UN. I'm the desk officer handling Liberia. I just wanted to ask two questions. One, has DINCO been sensitizing the public about the progress being made in the development of the army? And the second question is, given the delays in the restructuring exercise, could you share with us your thoughts on how the process can be expedited? Thank you.
I must say that in terms of sensitizing the public, initially, like I said from the very beginning, DINCO provided sufficient information, I would say, in my own thinking. They had radio announcements in all of the vernaculars. They had culture shows, dance shows as a way of getting the messages out. They put up billboards and posters and flyers. And there was a lot of talk about the issue. Now, if that is the kind of sensitization you're talking about, yes, they did provide that kind of sensitization. Since then, the government have been trying to get the message out as to what is happening with regards to training, the status of training, the duration of the training program, inviting the public to participate in events such as graduation, in exercises, Armed Forces Day celebration, and making sure that the public get an appreciation of the new military. So that before the recruits go into training, the list go out to the public. It is posted up with the name of the individual, his number, and a couple of cell phone numbers that you can call and provide sensitive information to, so the public is aware and involved as to the individuals that are coming. Yes, there have been some delay, but I can say that since I got in Washington yesterday, you know, I'm very pleased to hear the good news and very positive. The next training class of about 500 persons should be going in, hopefully, very, very soon. The funding is now right around the corner. It has been signed on. We just need a little process to get it into the accounts. So we are very pleased with that. And our understanding is that all efforts will be made to ensure that the rest of the funding comes handy to allow the process to continue. You understand how your own system works here in the States. You got Congress, you got the administration, so we have to follow what the process is. If there was a faster way any one of you have as to how we can get this money, I'll be very glad to listen to you and make that recommendation.
Minister, if I could just ask a follow-up to that question.
Yes, ma'am.
What has been the reaction by the Liberian people to these new vetting procedures? Have they been appreciative? Have they thought it's too restrictive?
Honestly, I think the 40 years of conflict of our country is the main problem. Because during the 14-year period, there have been about 8 different interventions that have interrupted the schooling of our young people for one reason or the other, whether it is riot, what is fighting, April 6th fighting, what is a new fighting by a new rebel faction. So because they have affected the continuity of education, some persons see it as a challenge, you know, for the diagnostic test, for an example. And let me give you an idea on the procedure. You do your application, you walk in, there's someone is always there at the gate. You say, look, I want to join the army. They say, oh, great, here's your application, here are my passport size photos. They give you a piece of paper, which is a literacy test. It says, my name is John, or it says, today is Wednesday, or it says, today is Friday. It determines that he or she can read and write. Then if you say, according to your application, you're a high school graduate, we'll get the documents from you later, but here is a diagnostic test. So it's a stop-and-go or process. So you get to the diagnostic test, you have to pass it in order to go to the next step. So once you pass the diagnostic test, then you go for the next step, which is medical test. That is to see whether you got heart pressure, your basic. And then after that, you go and do your physical test. And then from there on, you wait for the vetting process. Now, the vetting process will determine your human rights records. Your record as a person in your society. Your record whether you completed high school or whether you provided false information. If you provided false information, you will be advised that the information we have gathered contradicts the information you have provided. And you'll be asked the opportunity to see if you can correct whether it was an oversight or whether it was intentional. And if it is still clear that you intend to deceive, at that point in time, you are not recommended as a future recruit. So the whole process is your sincerity and integrity that you bring on the table. Nothing else. You bring that on the table, you will be accepted. We have former members of the AFL in the process. We have had former persons who partook in the war in one way or the other with very clean records after that. But yes, the vetting process is a little bit tough. There's some flexibility. Flexibility in a sense where the public is not saying anything as to the individual negatively. The individual himself may not provide all of the information, but we are not getting anything to contradict what we already have. So we allow the process to go, but he or she is on a one-year probation, according to the form and application you sign. One-year probation in the process, it would discover any derogatory information about you on your human rights or criminal record, or something in the public that can affect your status as a soldier during a 1 year period. Now, whether you get all of the high school graduates to meet your high school standards that you have, that is another question. Because today we have about 8,000 persons, and about 12% or so have successfully passed through the vetting process. It doesn't mean they are not passing the test. You may have a 90%, 50%, 60% or 70% passing rate on the test, but that in itself doesn't mean or qualify you to be a recruit. The vetting process now have to satisfy. It has an international with a lot of experience and a local who understand the local community very well. I'll give you one example. There was a case in which an individual said he never joined any of the rebel factions. During the vetting process, his wife stated on the record that in fact he was one of the commanders of the rebel faction. All right, so we confronted an individual, we didn't say his wife, but he was confronted with the information that in fact this is where he served, these are the people he commanded, with the opportunity to just be open. And if he was open, I guess he would have probably been in the AFL today. But he wasn't. He insisted that it was untrue. Now, we had no reason to believe that his wife was providing false information. So the process is tough, but I think if you begin to slacken the process now, given the history of our conflict, the conduct of the war that took place, and the depth of the sorrow and feelings, you would have compromised the entire objective from the very beginning. We believe that you can adjust along the way as follows. We need a personnel in the AFL band. So we said, you don't need to be a high school graduate to join the AFL band. You're only going to be a band member for the rest of your term. If you want to leave the band to come into the regular AFL, you have to come through the front door. So you can't use the band as a conduit to come into the armed forces of Liberia. We can be reasonable in that regards. For an example, if in future we decide to look for truck drivers, instead of utilizing our high school students to do that, we will specifically state that position is for truck drivers coming into join the army. So you don't expect to become a general later on, you know, after you become a truck driver. So we could make that very clear and be flexible. But until then, we want to be very clear as to the kinds of persons that we're bringing into the AFL.
Thanks. Good morning, Minister. My name is Allison Ford, and I'm with Catholic Relief Services, which provides humanitarian and development relief assistance in 98 countries worldwide, including in Liberia. One of the trends that we've noticed lately in worldwide and in West Africa is the increased funding by the Department of Defense of development projects, including health and education projects and obviously in other sectors. We're wondering to what degree you've seen this in Liberia, and what is your opinion of the increased funding of development projects by the U.S. military?
Thank you. I came along with my assistant minister for civil works, Sal Varma. He's sitting right in the front. Sal has been involved in traveling around the country to assess all of the military facilities, their present conditions, and how we can better utilize those facilities. To date, as I speak to you, we have not received any development funding yet for the armed forces of Liberia. However, what we have said is that the military owe it is as a civic duty to assist in the restructuring, in the reconstruction of our country. What it means is that we got clinics that need nurses, we got bridges that need to be fixed. Excuse me. There's a need for some assistance that the military, using its expertise and personnel, that they can provide. Maybe along the way, we might be able to do something like that. But I'm not sure what is going to be a major development effort. I probably see it more as a civic program to improve civic relations. Now, coming out of a war, mistrust, lack of confidence, you need to build that relationship back into the community. You could utilize the combat medics who have some training as nurses or the doctor to once in a while go and provide some services to the people in the different communities. UNMIL does the same thing. UNMI has its military mission, but there is a humanitarian element to that, to improve relationships, to reassure the community, to see the military as friendly. The United States military do the same thing. They come on tours to Liberia, for example. They go to the community or schools, repaint the schools, provide footballs for the people, help them in the clinic on how to clean the neighborhood, build wells, and other assistance. All of that, we believe, is a part of improving SIGMA relations. We will hope that the engineering battalion of the AFL that is coming up, we have some assistance to be able to assist the community to rebuild the roads. I traveled to some parts of Liberia, to many parts of Liberia, in locations where people have hardly gone. And I can tell you, and I think Mr. Klein can tell you that, you need serious, serious support and assistance. And one way is utilizing the skills in the military, the engineering unit, for an example. You can utilize them in order to provide some development assistance. If that being the case, yes. On the other hand, I think direct economic assistance for development will most likely have to go through the national coffers, like the Minister of Planning, in true coordination. In the case of Liberia, with what we call the LRDC, Liberia Reconstruction Development Committee. So those will be the angles, and I'm not sure it's going to be the military. I'd like to introduce the Honorable Senator Lahai Lasana. He's a senior senator from Bomi County. He's just arrived from Liberia.
Mr. Minister, my name is Phil Huff from U.S. Land Solutions. We clear landmines worldwide, including Iraq and Afghanistan. And I didn't make Admiral General. I only made Captain in the Navy, so you win so far. So my basic question is, after 15 years of war, do you have any landmine problems and or unexploded ordnance problems that stop your economic development?
Thank you. Although landmine in itself, as it is known, has not been a major problem since the war. However, UXOs are. And in recent times, there have been a lot of recovery. People are returning homes and they're going on their farms to begin the farms, and they are UXOs lying down around. We have had one or two cases where persons have gotten injured. But I must say that on-mill engineering contingents have been working assiduously. And the United Nations Development Program has what they call Arms for Development. That is one of the most successful programs of recovery of UXOs and other warlike materials in recent times, wherein the community is sensitized sufficiently as to what these warlike materials are, what they look like, the danger to the society, and say to the community, if all of you can collectively help us, talk to your children to find and recover and let us know the information of any of these items anywhere, tell us a project and we will build it for you. And that has worked and is working very, very successfully. So there have been recovery of a lot of UXOs in several dozens, and recovering spent shells or unexploded shells or ammunition that have not been utilized. We're talking about good quantity here. So it is working. But we do not have the your expertise, direct expertise there, but we're using on-mill skills to help us in the recovery program. There is a group called Landmine Action, I think from Britain, that is there in Liberia right now, but they're operating in Guthrie, in one of the rubber plantations where they're providing retraining and rehabilitation for about 400 former combatants. But UXO, yes, UXO are a problem. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Minister, Daniel Serwer from the U.S. Institute of Peace. You've just mentioned retraining of former combatants, and that's what I wanted to ask about.
Okay.
What's happening to all these people whom you're rejecting for the armed forces, and more generally, what's happening to the former combatants?
Thank you very much. I'm not sure whether we're rejecting people, except that the standards, are just up there that, people need to meet. But indeed, I understand you correctly, yes. Those who have interest in wanting to join, but have not been able to meet the standards or the criteria set, particularly former combatants who have been exposed to weapons, there are training programs that have been provided to them. Yet, I think there's a need for one step beyond that training program. You know, when you are in the military or in working for the UN and you're about to retire for any reason or provide severance, there is, I'm sure, some kind of workshop or some kind of seminar to help you in the transition to move from where you are into the next phase of your own life. I think that was absent. That was noticeably absent since the entire process began, long before the transition, the interim government, the president came in. To sensitize them, not just by a billboard publication, but by face-to-face discussion, to let them know what life is out there, what is expected. So there have been a lot of training. I am told over 90,000 persons, in one way or the other, who have been former combatants, have been provided some kind of training, some kind of rehabilitation process, but it hasn't really settled down as to which way they're supposed to go thereafter. So that will be needed sometime along the way, so that people can see that there are other alternatives in utilizing the skills that they may have been exposed to. Say, for example, a former personnel of the AFL who was in the personnel section, in the S1 section or G1 section. He or she might have some administrative skills that they may not be aware of how to utilize those skills, how to even draft an application letter, how to prepare a resume, for an example, how to do a little bit of research. That is why the government is trying to bring in the Bureau of Veteran Affairs. The Bureau of Veteran Affairs will serve as an advocacy group for these former AFL personnel, for an example, those who have been retired and those who have been severe, so that they can have some ideas of other options, other alternatives, how to utilize those skills and training that they had. I'll give you one good example. In Monrovia, if you know Monrovia well, just before you get to the Pan-African Plaza, before the Monrovia City Hall, there's a little carpenter workshop right there at the on-mill checkpoint. That workshop, if that workshop was being used by former AFL soldiers or person with skills in carpentry, they would have gotten the contract to build the chop boxes for the 500 soldiers that are coming in. So someone needs to be able to tell those former AFL personnel, former combatants, or who have some skills, that if you organize yourself in some shape or form, you can be able to get some contracts. I'll give you another example. The World Bank provided about $7 million to Liberia for the cleaning and of the Monrovia City, the drainage system, the sewage system, the different yards and market areas that need to be cleaned. If these persons were being trained on how to organize themselves as a group, they could have been able to apply for some of those services and see if they can get some benefit and give them some job. That is where we believe institutions, agencies, or groups that have such knowledge and capability of how to organize people in a more productive way, how to get people to utilize those skills, it will be very possible for Liberian former combatants to be able to benefit from that. That is a gap that needs to be filled. You have many persons out there with skills. They don't know what to do with those skills. Not bad skills, but good skills.
Are there other questions for the minister?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Mr. Minister, just a simple question. I'm Ken Yates of Jefferson Wyman International.
Yes, sir.
One of the difficulties with the former combatants are they're still out there somewhere. And we hear stories and rumors that there are informal groups, maybe former AFL people who are officers who are no longer a part of the military, who are organizing informal squads out there that could be used for combat. To what extent do you feel these present a danger to your activities? The second question is, what efforts are being made to provide some sort of tribal balance within the new AFL, and how does that affect your selection process?
Thank you. I take the latter question first. I think that is a very, very important aspect of the vetting process and the process of approving the recruiting listing by the Joint Personnel Board, where we have to go to a geographic representation of all of the ethnic groups in our country. There is no hand-picked way it is being done, since people are voluntarily coming. However, the process is put in place in a way that it goes into the system, and the system is told that no single ethnic group, for example, should exceed 16%. All right, so it comes out and say, okay, these are all the applicants you have. You have from 2%. To an average, to 13%. So which means that there's no single dominance by any single group or influence by any person, including the Minister of Defense. I cannot influence the process as to who goes in. Neither does the Commander-in-Chief have the ability to influence the process. The handlers cannot influence the process at all. So all of the information goes in, and you get that kind of input. And to date, the higher percentage has been 16%, which is not really strange, but it is a new phenomenon because it's coming from a region where they haven't had too much interest. For an example, I'll tell you that, and that is, for an example, Grand Bassa County. Or I'll give you an example of Bong County, for an example, which is from the central region. And then, of course, the traditional group of the people from Lofa County. But there have been a drastically lower element coming from Nimba County, for an example, where most of the former MPFL were coming from. A drastic reduction of persons from the southeastern region, that is from Grand Jeter, most of whom were in the former EFL before. We suspect that people may want to wait to see what will happen in the first training class, and then subsequently the second class, and then maybe the third training class, who might have many other persons coming. Because they wanted to see what the government will pay, as the government is saying, what will give them houses, as we are saying, what will give them training. And I think so far, we've done all of that, including insurance for they themselves, their wife, and eligible dependent below the age of 17. So we have been able to do something. And also, we are not recruiting. We are not recruiting on the basis of ethnicity. We ask you, you can put your ethnic, you can put your tribe. It's voluntary, you may, but we appreciate if you do that for statistical purposes. It has no bearing on the decision as to who comes in or who is not brought into the army. The vetting process does not take that in as a factor. It is only the database men at the end. In fact, they didn't do it from the beginning. We requested them to go back and sort that information out, so that we have statistics that we usually give out whenever a recruiting class is going into training. We give out to the public, it's in the newspapers for everyone to see the statistics of persons in this new recruit class, including the statistics of women, vis-a-vis college graduate or high school graduates. So there's a flow of information, but nothing on ethnicity to create any bias. On the issue of the former combatants organizing themselves, yes, there have been a lot of rumors of persons not being happy, no jobs. You can imagine someone taking care of this family for 15, 16 years, and then out of a sudden, things get a little bit not the same way it used to be. There is frustration. So in order to address that, the Bureau of Veteran Affairs is being created by government, waiting for legislation, so the soldiers can be, in soldiers' interest, the former soldiers' interest, can be advocated for. Secondly, the economy has been down. We were under the timber industry were under sanction, the diamond industry were under sanction. Many other persons who wanted to invest in labor intensive jobs couldn't because of the sanction. Now in recent times those sanctions have been lifted thanks to the American people once again and thanks to the international community for considering Liberia in that regards. So it is hopeful that with new investment coming, there might be employment opportunities and there'll be other opportunities to allow people to be able to empower themselves by finding and seeking jobs.
Good morning, Phil Reed from the Africa Faith and Justice Network. I'm just wondering if you could be more specific about the credible presence of AFRICOM that you would wish for your country and what implications having a foreign military command structure in a sovereign nation might have.
Well, let me put it this way. We don't see it as a foreign nation, imposing itself in any way on a sovereign nation. I give you a very clear example. There is a glaring call by the international community, including the Americans, for the situation in Darfur. There is a glaring call. So that means the international community has interest in the stability of the region, in the welfare of people around the world. In Liberia during the conflict, there was a glaring call by many Americans for American intervention to stop the mayhem and destruction. So the whole idea is not to wait for it to happen, but to have a presence that serves as a reassuring factor, not only to the country, but to the region where the conflict has been spiraling, from Liberia to Sierra Leone, Guinea is all of us concerned, and then Africa that have also been in conflict. With a presence that allow for training and interaction in the region, with the ECOWAS standby force, the involvement of Africa in the process, we believe that is going to be very, very healthy for the region. But I'll add one more point. You will notice that during the Cold War time, Liberia stood by America. We were literally the only country in Africa at that time that was prepared to host the strategic interests of the United States when every other African country were going negative. We stood by the American people at the time when it was needed. We stood by the American people at the time to protect their strategic interest. We stood by them all along as friends in the entire process. We have never turned our back on the American people out there in our country. The friendship of our country, the history of our two countries goes back. Liberia's first president came from St. Petersburg, Virginia. So it goes back to the history of our two people. When you speak to West Africans, ask them the following question. If you ask someone who, say, for an example, from Ghana, where are you going on holidays? He's going to say London. If you ask someone from Abidjan, where are you going on holidays? He's going to say Paris. If you ask a Liberian, you don't say where are you going, you ask him what state you go into. All right, so it is very clear that our historical ties goes way back. And not only the political will, but the friendship of the Liberian people. It is the people of Liberia that is saying you are more than welcome as we always done to you before. And that strategic interest will be preserved not only by the political administration, but by the Liberian people themselves.
Thank you very much. Are there any sort of last questions, very briefly? You can ask from there, sure.
I was wondering, the former combatants had off long in the group, are you probably on the census at Kimball or Lake about the Bureau of Justice system and the court system? Are you tying any of these combatants or are you just integrating?
No, I think. There's no war crimes for any action that may have been taken unless you have a case to take to the courts. I think the justice system is also undergoing a reform and review process and restructuring process with the assistance of the United Nations on MIL. I think Mr. Jack Clan started that process. It's continuing. And the United States and the generosity of the American people once again in helping to provide support to our judges and the judicial system. The court system are undergoing restructuring and reform, and I think there is a need for that, and it's ongoing right now. Former combatants are only taking the court on case-by-case basis. That is, if I have a personal case against you and I have the evidence, nothing stops you from going to court. So, but there's no direct targeting of persons, say, there's a group taking former combatants to court. I haven't seen a case in that respect. However, we're trying to see how all of us can reconcile what has happened. We have the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which is an opportunity for people to go out. And we have had cases in which people have gone out, two families, one the victim and one the perpetrator of the act. And they both go and they publicly talk what has happened. And, you know, there's some emotional scenes as to, you know, how it is, you know. And then finally the person say, look, you know, I forgive you or something of that sort. It is a very, very tough exercise. If you have watched the South African Truth and Reconciliation process, it's a very emotional exercise and it's not an easy one. But that is ongoing in Liberia. So there's no targeting of former combatants or highlighting them in any shape or form.
Even though it's directly in California?
Yes, ma'am. As a matter of fact, just on Tuesday this week, I was in a local restaurant on Mecklen Street. And if you remember the picture of Charles Taylor going on the aircraft, the gentleman who was behind him, his security aide with the bald head, or Sibiu as it's called, he and I were in the same restaurant together. While he was eating on the other table, I was eating on the other table. I mean, how much more reconciliation can we not have? So it is possible that we can live once again in the same society. We have to find a way to move on. We have to find a way to reconcile. We have to find a way to forgive, but it should not be on the basis of impunity for those who are held liable for bringing us the conflict. That's where we find ourselves. So you're absolutely right, man. It is tough, but Liberians want to reconcile and move on.
Well, on that positive note, I want to thank the minister for his time and thank you all for coming.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's good seeing you.